This is Car Expert.
Because Mitsubishi is so synonymous with that technology, that if it's struggling to get any cutthroat recognition, then it stands to reason that everybody is.
If it had something to really justify that extra expense, I'd be able to say, hey, look, put the Jeep Compass on your list.
In particular, the GT line, it's just something about it. I want it.
My name's Mandy Turner. G'day, Tony Crawford.
Mandy, how are you? I'm so happy to be here. Talk about cars.
Well, that's what all we do. That's what we do. Jack Quick, hello.
Hello, I'm back again.
I know. Yeah. Well, last time we had you on, you were talking about your history with cars, and you mentioned that you've got a Suzuki Jimny as your daily, which is just awesome.
I do.
But it appears another Jimny has joined the family.
Well, yes. I suppose you'd almost call it like a little twist in the story. So it's been maybe like 3 weeks since I was last on the podcast, something like that. And in between that time, it turns out my family has gained another Suzuki Jimny. So it was a surprise to me, and it was also a surprise to my sister, because she is now the owner of a brand new manual Suzuki Jimny as well. It's a white one, and she just picked it up Friday last week, so it's still pretty fresh. They went all the way to Mildura to pick it up because that's like their local dealer for them. And they were waiting
from
about
Melbourne.
Yeah.
That's a long way.
Yeah, so I'm not originally from Melbourne. They were from the living on the farm. So I think it's about 3.5 hour drive to Mildura. I can't be exactly
certain. From the
farm. Yeah, from the farm. They got up at 6 a.m. and they went all the way to Mildura, and they took their photos with the car and had the bow, and it was adorable. And I got pictures sent to me, and I did a FaceTime, and I was like, oh, my God, that's amazing. So, they were waiting about 6 months for the car. It's still a long wait. It's a white one. To complement my blue one, my blue one. They've now got a white one, so I'm really looking forward to taking some pictures side by side, kind of getting this, like, accessorizing it, having a bit of a fiddle. It's going to be
without her knowing, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of the I might just get her some presents and things like that. It's like I have this in my Jimny. I'm going to get you this too.
And had she shown interest in that sort of a vehicle?
Well, I know that she really liked my Jimny, and it was a present from my family. She was just kind of like, yeah, I like this. And I think Dad kind of subconsciously thought, yeah, we'll get another.
that farm, it's you're not in the hemp business, are you?
No, we're just primary producers. We do the grain and sheep and stuff. So it's been tough, but we've had a few good seasons for the last few years, and it looks like it's going to be another good season again. So, yeah, good
Fantastic.
Times.
Excellent.
I can see instead of Clarkson's farm, it'll be Jack's farm soon. Get the Jimny out in the field, have a bit of fun.
Doing some races, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Hey, Croft, you were on the phone to me today talking about a book that you've recently purchased, and you and I love Porsche 911s. And
I know you do.
I'm a little jealous about the book.
Yeah, look, this book, I think I paid like €500 for this book, Mandy. It's called The Ultimate Book of the Air Cooled Porsche 911 by.
Sure, does look ultimate.
by Veloce, and the author is Brian Long. It comes in pity I can't show everyone, but comes in like a special hard cover thing, and the book pops.
Coffee table book
pops out of its sleeve. It's
a
huge thing. It's a huge book.
I love how everyone's going to be hearing like all the squeaks and things.
Yeah, it starts with the 356 Porsche, which you own, Mandy, and goes all the way right through to all the air cooled Porsches. The reason I've pulled it out and I've got it here is I've had about five different people call me saying they're buying air-cooled Porsches, and they're looking on collecting cars, and they're looking at buying them in England, and they're asking me what colours and trim levels they came in. And of each year in this book, it shows all the colourways, the exterior colourways, and all the interior trims of what they are, whether it's Berber or cloth or leather or and the colours, and it has the actual colour patch right there of every year that Porsche built cars, and whether it's a 964, 993, a G, 911 SC or 911 Carrera 3.2, everything is in there. And a guy, one of my good friends was buying a Supersport 911, and he called me and I said, mate, I can't find any mention of Supersport in this book. So it's either a new thing that someone's coined on collecting cars, and apparently with G-Series particularly, you could buy what the factory called a turbo look, which was a turbo body with uprated suspension and uprated braking system. And that's apparently what people are now referring to as the Supersport. So this book basically says that that didn't exist from the factory perspective. It was called the Turbo Look, quote unquote. So anyway, look, it's just a great reference. If anyone is buying a 911 air cooled, go on to carexpert.com.au and send me an email, and I'll let you know, and I'll photograph the pages for you and send them to you if you want.
I'm assuming all the books have been sold, seeing as there's not many. Well, do you know?
It's a good question because it is one of 911 books.
Yeah.
It is, in fact, number 522 of 911. So, yeah, I imagine it's quite a rare book. And, of course, €500 is no small amount of money to pay for a book. Mm. I've got a lot of other books on 911s, but that's probably the go-to and definitive book. Yeah, interesting.
Has it got the colour codes of the old 911 that you used to own, Croft? The blue one that you were talking about a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, it does. Pacific blue metallic, yeah. And there was like three or four. But it's really interesting how 1 year they had, you know, three or four blues, and next year they had one blue. So yeah, look, it's a fantastic book if anyone is buying an older 911, and they're really going up in prices, we all know. In fact, every 911 bar the 996, which had the spaghetti fried egg front headlights, is going up. So if anyone wants a 911 that doesn't want to pay big money, go for a 996. I'm not sure they'll go up in value. Not anytime soon, I think, because I think people, genuine Porsche people, don't like that fried egg setup of the front lights.
I feel like they're getting a new following, though. Like, I'm not a big fan of them, but I'm finding on Facebook pages and forums that people are starting to come around. Yeah.
Are they? I don't know, Mandy. The guy that designed that should be shot if he hasn't already died. It's a travesty to think of all those years of building that car, and why would you want to change anything? I mean, that's what Porsche 911s are all about. You know, the evolution is almost perfect. And nothing changes that doesn't need to be changed, and that continues today, right? The round headlights, the only generation where they change the front headlights, and of course they're not worth, and they've never been worth big money. But I hope you're right, because you can get into them really cheap. And I have to say, the turbo model looks fantastic at the rear because it's got this brilliant rear whale tail that molds into the body itself. It looks really good.
Yeah. So anyway, I tell you what, there's one other thing I didn't like that Porsche introduced, and it was on the 911 that I had. This one was imported from America, but it was 1974, the first year of the rubber bumpers.
Oh, yeah.
And they had to introduce it because
I think it's a California law.
Yeah, for American law.
California law.
Yeah, it's just that they didn't look great at all.
No. Look, they did that with every model. Unfortunately, the Mercedes Sports SLC copped that as well with huge rubber bumpers, you know.
Yeah.
They never look good. I mean, cars don't look good with number plates either. In America, largely, they look terrible. They're not made to have number plates. And I don't know.
Well, we could talk about this all day, but 100%. We probably should start the podcast.
We should.
And we will start with news. One of the, undoubtedly the best looking car that Kia has ever made, and we haven't even seen it yet, and it's going to be a while away, the EV6 GT. When are we going to finally see this one, Jack?
Not for a while just yet. So it's roughly going to be about 12 to 18 months away at this stage.
Ouch.
Yeah, so it's a fair way off. I thought it was going to be a little bit sooner myself. I know that the normal model is supposed to be coming in the first half of next year in 2022. So it gives us something to look forward to in a sense. But the GT, like the proper high-performance model, variant won't be coming for a little while just yet. But it when it does come, I know that there'll be a whole big hullabaloo, and because it's a little pocket, I say little, it's a pocket rocket. It's a high performance machine. It has 430 kilowatts of power and 740 newton meters of torque. So I remember seeing it's like RS6 rivaling performance, wow, and almost Tesla Model 3 rivaling performance too. And that comes from the dual electric motors making it all-wheel drive, which is pretty cool. Wow. And it can also do 0 to 100 in 3.5 seconds. You might have seen the marketing video of where they have the EV6 lined up against a whole heap of other supercars, and it just takes off and it's flat out. It's awesome to see. It's exciting to think it's going to be on the roads just in like everyday people's hands or at their disposal. Yeah, exactly. It's a Kia. How cool is that? Yeah. and the top speed of the EV6 GT is going to be 260 Ks an hour, which we won't be able to do obviously here in Australia, but it's pretty cool to do nonetheless. For this GT model in particular, it has a WLTP test cycle range of 405 kilometers, and as we talked about just then, it's going to be one of the coolest and the most expensive Kia models that the company has ever offered here in Australia, and it's going to be very, very similar, as I said just before, to the Model 3. So because with the Model 3, it is very similar 0 to 100. It's 3.3 seconds to 100, 100 k's an hour, so 0.2 of a second difference, and it has a 261 kilometer per hour top speed, which is only one different. And for the Model 3 performance, it's currently $84,900 before on-road costs, which might get be some kind of reference to what the EV6 GT may cost when it arrives, whenever it does, 12 to 18 months' time. We're kind of thinking it might launch at the 2023 Australian Open, because Kia is a major sponsor there. So it'll be a cool little like thing to have it like roll up and say, look at this EV6 GT, go for a little whip around or have a sit in it, because it looks awesome. I love the matte paint, the satin paint that it comes in. Mm. And it just looks awesome. But I'm really looking forward to we just talked about the whole big performance one, but I'm really looking forward to the regular models, the base and also the GT line. In particular, the GT line, it's just something about it. I want it.
I think we all do, Jack.
It just seems more attainable, I suppose, as kind of like a first electric car for me to buy potentially here in Australia. And it's interesting, joining with the arrival of the Ioniq 5 and then the Model 3. And I kind of think that I'd go for the EV6, I'm not going to lie.
Don't forget we've got the Model Y coming in from Tesla, which is probably more of a competitor given that it's the SUV version of Model 3. So, because this is quite a big crossover, this EV6, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. It's deceptive. It looks like it'd be kind of small, just like a regular hatchback, but no, it's pretty big. It's like Sportage size, if not in between Sportage and Sorento size, so it's big.
Yeah. It looks cool.
It does. Oh, it sure does.
The rear shot that I'm looking at on Kia's website is amazing.
Yeah, it almost looks Aston Martin DBX-esque. That's what I see, yeah.
It actually might look better than the Aston Martin, I have to say.
I'm agreeing with you there, Crawf.
Yeah, it really looks spectacular. And I think I'm looking at the GT. I guess they would be putting photos of that up on their site.
I would assume so, yeah.
Yeah, which is the matte grey, which you're right, looks absolutely brilliant. This is what I mean. We're really... I mean, Kia's tagline right there is electric is coming fast.
Yep.
And, you know, that's a double meaning there because it's obviously very quick as you just outlined, Jack, but this stuff is around the corner. And you know, I guess the FEV thing there, I don't want to go into the FEV thing again, we've labored on it too long, but this is where it's all heading right now, isn't it? Into fully battery electric vehicles and, you know, 18 months away for the GT line, we might even have new battery technology by then. Ultium, I think, is a new type of battery that's coming.
Oh, yeah, there's Ultium. There's
stacks. There's so much happening in it. I kind of liken it to the cure for COVID-19. Everyone's working on new battery technology right now. So I think there's going to be an explosion of these type of vehicles. And you're right, it's commendable to even the likes of Mitsubishi with their FEV and, you know, bringing all this stuff and introducing it to people as quickly as possible is, you know, really good. And, you know, it'll see a quicker transition away from petrochemicals, you know.
Yeah. Well, we're actually going to talk about Mitsubishi FEV coming up very shortly. But while we're still on this sort of subject and really cool Korean-made cars, Croft, the 2022 Hyundai Ioniq 5, we've got all the details for this one.
Yeah, well, the difference of this one, I've actually had a really good look at this thing close up and been in it and posted a whole bunch of stuff on social. This is like the Kia, I think this is a spectacularly good-looking vehicle. And it's around the corner, as I said. It goes on sale September 2021. Because of the demand and the initial allotment of 400 only units. Yeah, 400 only units. Hyundai are selling this directly, so you'll order it online. And, of course, there have been a lot of people. I was just reading the amount of people that have put deposits down, it is just absolutely amazing. Something like 11,000 expressions of interest and 120 deposits of $2,000 have already been put down on this vehicle. Over the last 8 months, which is unprecedented according to Hyundai Australia. And, this car is set to do some massive numbers. I suspect they just won't be able to get enough stock.
Yeah, true. How much is it?
It starts at 71,900.
Do you think that's a good price?
Before on roads. Sorry?
You reckon that's a good price?
I do. I do. This is a big vehicle, Mandy. As Jack just said, this is sportage, if not bigger. Bigger because you don't have the transmission tunnel or anything. It's a flat floor. It's huge. In the rear boot space looked to be about 600 litres to my mind, if not more. It's massive. I don't have all the specs on it.
I do know that the Ioniq 5 is on the same platform as the Palisade. So
yeah,
it's meant to be huge.
It's big. It's really big. But looking at that Kia EV6, it looks equally large. It's going to, for the entry level, you're going to get 160 kilowatt single motor to the rear axle. And you'll have 225 kilowatts for the dual motor all-wheel drive variants. So some very different. It has a 400 volt and an 800 volt charging capability, plus vehicle to vehicle function that allows you to provide up to 3.6 kilowatts of power to charge devices like electric bikes, scooters, and all that stuff at home. So you can use it as a, you know, like a charging wall as well. It's just stacked with features. If anyone wants to look, Car Expert probably has posted on their Instagram and Facebook page today some stuff I did with it. It's absolutely brilliant. It comes with a stack of features. I'll read you the features. By the way, that Ioniq 5 all-wheel drive will be priced at $75,900, so not a lot extra. And I tell you what, from $71,900 to $75,000 for all that extra punch. So you go from 7.4 seconds or to 100 down to 5.2. And I suspect more kit. If you go on our, if you go on carexpert.com.au and look at the pricing and specs piece, written by Will Stopford, you can see every feature there. And it, honestly, I couldn't read the list of features that it comes with. It's enormous. From heated steering wheels to keyless entry and start, remote smart parking assist, you know, where you can move the car. I think Paul Marrick posted something on social the other day on our Insta page where the car was started up remotely and then reversed back. You know, this is really, really – Jack, you might know more about this than I do in terms of spec-for-spec features.
Yeah, but I do know something. So these models, the initial 400 is kind of like a launch model of – a launch edition of sorts. So like a lower specs and also base models are going to be coming later on. But just for now, we're going to get everything. Even though there are only 400 coming whenever they do. I can't quite remember when. But it's going to be fully loaded and going to have everything that the Ioniq 5 can offer, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I can read you some of these features. I mean, blind spot assist, blind spot view monitor, adaptive cruise with stop go, auto high beam, intelligent speed limit, lane key. It's got so many safety features. I can't read them all out. It's endless. Then you go to the features: Bose 8-speaker sound system, 12.3-inch touchscreen, wired Android Auto and Apple CarPlay, sat nav, everything, like literally LED headlights and tail lights, just a lot,
just a lot. Listen, a halogen.
Yeah. So when you start looking at the number of features and you look at the price, and don't forget, we're talking about a very quick battery, you know, full EV. I'm thinking this is. I was thinking it was going to be a lot higher than this, Mandy and Jack. I'm really surprised they've been able to land this at 71.9 plus on roads and 75.9 for the dual motor.
Pretty competitive, definitely.
It really is. I mean, that all-wheel drive powertrain is 225 kilowatts and 605 newton meters. Both powertrains use a 72.6 kilowatt hour lithium-ion battery. You've got 17.9 kilowatt hour to 100 Ks in the rear wheel variant, 19 kilowatt hour to 100 Ks in the all wheel drive model, which means you can, in the top spec, you can charge up to 350 kilowatt hours, which is the same as the Porsche Taycan for DC fast charging, which means you'll be able to charge this from 10 to 80% in 17 minutes if you get the fast charging network. And, of course, that's another discussion entirely because we all know Tesla's fast charging network is complete. It is incredible. You can go from Sydney to Melbourne, Sydney to Brisbane using their fast charging network. But I suspect all these guys will ramp up their access to fast charging networks very quickly. And there is talk, of course, Tesla opening their fast charging network up to everybody, obviously paid, of course. But yeah, Mandy, I was ecstatic at this vehicle. It's just, it's futuristic and it's here now.
Nothing like it on the road.
Nothing like it. And I suspect that the EV6 will be the same. Jack, when does the standard EV6 land?
It's supposed to be in the first half of 2022, so like early, like next year sometime.
Yeah.
I think it's also maybe going to have some sort of part to do maybe at the Australian Open, the one that's coming up. So roughly around about that time. In Europe, it's already out. So
yeah,
you know, it's kind of lagging behind a little. And I do have one more thing. Do you reckon you'd go Ioniq 5 or EV6?
God, I'm gonna say EV6 for stylistic purposes because I just love that rear end, and I it's the same with Sportage and Tucson for me. I've become quite the Kia fan. Look, Hyundai's not far behind. I think they're two very different executions, design executions. I don't think you can go wrong with either. To be honest, I did want to point out the fact that the Ioniq 5's battery is covered for 8 years or 160,000 kilometres, whichever comes first. And there is no service pricing announced yet with that vehicle. So we don't know. I suspect they're going to be fairly low, right, guys? I mean, you know, there's no engine oil to there's no synthetic engine oil at $85 a pop. You know, like we're going to – I think there's some really interesting ownership propositions with battery electric vehicles going forward. Yeah, it's a whole new world. It's a brave new world out there, and I think it's going to be fun.
Absolutely. It's going to be exciting, yes.
Well, we're going to leave EVs aside for a second and go back to a normal everyday car you see on the road, the 2022 Mazda 2. We've got some updates for it, Crawf, and the G15 Pure SP joins the range.
Yes, Mandy, it's not quite the Ioniq 5 or the EV6. You're very right there. But I will say that the Mazda 2 was once my favourite small car. Particularly in the top spec. In fact, I bought one for one of my daughters to use, and she adored the car. It was a top spec. It had LED headlights. It had everything going for it. I still think it's a good-looking car, and that was like 2016, by the way, and we're in 2021. Wow. Yep, the G15 Pure SP variant, a little bit confused on the SP because the SP used to be sort of a performance-type variant, but with Mazda, I thought. But this has – it's based on the G15 Pure hatchback, which is the entry level. But that accounts for around half Mazda 2's total sales, which is interesting. So the SP gains black 16-inch alloy wheels, black bit of a black pack, I have to say here, black exterior mirrors, a black grille, and a chrome exhaust extension, black trim cloth upholstery with red highlights and brown cloth trim of the GV. Look, yeah, look, just a bit of a – bit of a tart up, if you like, but it's entry level, and they give you a bit more fizz in the entry level car. Nothing wrong with that at all, to be honest. What more can I say about this vehicle?
I do know this is kind of off the back of Mazda's been kind of doing little bits and pieces off over like all of their range at the moment. So has a new color and it has like a little bit of gloss black trim or like a new trim level or like even I think I remember seeing like the new mild hybrid engine being putting in like some of the Mazda range. So they're just doing little bits and pieces just to kind of keep it fresh. I don't know if it's for me, but it's a little something, and I've got to commend them for that. So,
Look, they were always really good paint jobs, and they are here. You've got, I'm just reading, you've got Sonic Silver. You've also got White Mica Pearl options offered at no cost. I mean, this was always a good car. It was a very, very good car. The interior of the Mazda 2 was right up there with, you know, more expensive Mazdas with that beautiful plastics they use. They really do it well, Mazda. They really are, to me, it's a premium Japanese brand, and you get that as in an entry-level Mazda too. So good on Mazda. They're doing well. They've always done well. They're continuing to be right up there in the on the podium generally. And there's nothing wrong with the Mazda 2 and the entry level with more stuff.
Can't hurt. Yeah, exactly. All right. Lastly, Jack, Vic Roads, which is the place Victorians go to get their licenses and registrations all sorted. There's some big movements happening there.
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird one. It's a bit like, I don't know how I feel about it. It's a bit strange. So to kind of get into the whole crux of it. So Vic Roads is offering $22,000 bonuses to retain staff. So Vic Roads is kind of gearing up to partially privatize the licensing and car registration, which is kind of weird. I don't know.
And, so odd. That's so strange to me.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
It's just for a bit of money. I don't really get it. Yeah. So 900 jobs are going to be retained in this partial privatization, but it's uncertain how many bonuses are going to be offered. The 22 grand bonuses are going to be offered to current staff to keep their jobs. But so if all 900 of these jobs, if all of them get 22 grand bonuses, it's going to almost total $20 million, which is a lot. So they really want to keep their staff. So I remember reading that that losing staff isn't an option. They really want to do anything to retain their staff that are on. So and the way that will work is when they say, yes, I want to keep my job here, they'll get a $2,000 sign-on bonus, and then after 3 months, they'll get 10 grand. And then if they're still there for another 12 months, they'll get another 10 grand, which kind of totals up the 22 grand. So it's nice. I don't know. Like, yeah. So, with this, if they choose to stay on their jobs, stay with their jobs, they'll have a 3-year contract. It's left a lot of people confused and kind of scared and not really certain what to do, whether to stay, whether to go. There's been kind of like a lot of legal threats as well from like workers' rights kind of saying, what do I do? Like, are they allowed to do this? All that kind of thing. And all of this is kind of originating from the government wanting to bring a fresh perspective to Vic Roads. So they're bringing in this partner who we don't know who that is yet, but they want to freshen it up. And I'm not certain what their intentions are, but I'd assume that they want to make some money. So, and I think that's going to be at our cost, unfortunately. So, or Victorians. So,
presumably, yeah. Jack, they're selling the business to this private entity, are they?
Yeah,
and
also,
gonna pocket a stack of cash up front, and then get a trailing interest in perpetuity for a portion of the profits, I guess.
Yeah, it's going to be like a joint venture between the government and this partner. And so to kind of put into context, last year Vic Roads earned $1.8 billion. So that's a lot. That's kind of been talking about this whole kind of segment. It's just a lot of money, and it's kind of hard to like picture that amount of money being generated from our roads and from our registrations and all that kind of stuff.
Is that fines as well? No.
I don't think so. Right. It's only from registrations and
licensing and stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Registration and licensing. So with this partnership, they're going to be with their potential partner, they're looking long term. So they're looking 30 to 40 years. So they're in it for a long time. And I think they want to make a lot of money. So yes, well, it's going to be interesting. Watch this space.
That's how these government contracts work. The privateers get in there, they pay some cash, and they generally start recouping money more quickly than you can believe. And then it's all profit, and we start getting higher prices. What's happened in New South Wales, Service New South Wales, which is a government organisation, but they have farmed off the My Plates, which are the private plates, registration plates that almost everyone is into now. Like, you, it's hard to find someone that doesn't have some sort of a premium plate, whether it's entry-level premium or completely bespoke. And, you know, some of those plates in I actually have some really ordinary black and yellow plates on the 911 now, because in protest for the $475 they wanted to charge me per annum to have not, you know, like, to, you know, Roman numerals, if you like, for 911. And I refused to pay. So I said, give me the cheapest plates. It was like $45 for that. But they look terrible. They look terrible. And I've now found a $111 option that I have to pay each year rather than $470. So they almost make you, because they produce such terrible standard plates, the black and yellow, they've almost forced us into using this private company, which must be making an absolute killing because you can't buy them outright. And for sure, the Service New South Wales are being nicely rewarded with part of the profits from this company. And it's and the service is terrible. I don't envy you going down this route, Victoria, because you will pay in the long run.
I will quickly just touch on. So this is kind of meant to take effect next year, early next year. And then staff will have the option whether to opt in or opt out roughly mid-2022. So it's going to be happening sooner than we think. So brace for impact.
Buy those personalized plates now before you can. All right, that wraps up this week's car news. The 2022 Jeep Compass has had a refresh, but does it still represent good value? William Stopford is the guy to ask. Hello, Will.
Hi, Mandy. Look, I'm not sure it really represented good value before, and I wouldn't say it does now. Now, I should say that's not because it is a bad car. This is a fundamentally decent car, but as I mentioned in my review, our tester in particular feels about $5,000 overpriced.
Well, Will, can I ask you which spec you had of the Compass? Which trim level?
The S Limited.
Right.
So basically, there's the front-wheel drive launch edition, and then you go limited, S limited, and then there's the Trailhawk at the very top of the range. Right. So the S limited is priced at $46,950 before on-road costs, which is already, if you just consider this, this is a small SUV. It might be a pretty spacious small SUV. It's certainly roomier than a Kona by quite a stretch, but that is what you would pay for a top spec midsize SUV. So already we're operating at a bit of a disadvantage here. Our tester also came with the S Limited Premium Package that added $2,950. So all up, you're looking at $50,545. And drive away, based on a Sydney postcode, you're looking at just basically a few dollars underneath $55,000 drive away.
Okay, I thought a Seltos top spec was around $44,000 drive away, $45,000.
Yeah. That's right? About right.
Wow.
That's where I kind of got that $5,000 figure from. And if you look at the very base model in the Compass range, it's still a few thousand dollars over a comparably specified Eclipse Cross or Seltos or Kona. So
it is a Jeep.
It is a Jeep, but is it
off-road capable, which a Seltos is probably not.
Charitable.
Objective here. Only because Jeep do make off-road capable vehicles and always have done so, which I would not probably want to put a Seltos off-road too far down the track.
I probably wouldn't really want to take a Compass too far off the track either. I mean, this isn't a Wrangler. It does come standard with Jeep's Active Drive Low 4x4 systems. There's a one-speed transfer case. There's hill descent control. There's different modes for snow and sand and mud. There's a selectable four-wheel drive low mode, but it's not low-range gearing. It just kind of locks the transmission in first gear.
Yeah.
Look, I would probably be a little bit more comfortable taking this off-road than I would even an all-wheel drive Kona or an all-wheel drive Seltos.
Yeah.
But there's not a massive amount of – I mean, maybe we should get Simon Christie behind the wheel of one of these. He tested the Trailhawk, which is a kind of a different beast. I believe it's got a little bit more ground clearance. But fundamentally, this is a crossover. It's a small crossover. It doesn't have that much more off-road ability than anything else in this class.
Okay.
So it really then does come down to what you said, right, Croft? It is a Jeep. So maybe that's the kind of perceived brand cachet might convince people to jump over to it. Now, it does do plenty of things well. The new interior, like the old interior was all right. Not the best.
Is it a big step up from the previous gen?
Yeah, look, I would say that the interior is a big step up, and that is not to say the last interior was crap. It was fine, but this new interior is genuinely nice. You've got soft touch materials. You've got stitching details everywhere. You've got a nice design. In limited and up, you've got a digital instrument cluster, if that's your thing. Personally, I'm not a massive fan of digital instrument clusters. The interior genuinely presents really well. And with this S Limited Premium Package, it had the panoramic sunroof. It had heated and ventilated front seats. So it was pretty luxed up. You're looking at a very long feature list. But you're also looking at a pretty high price tag. And that's not the only figure that's a bit on the high end, because fuel economy is not great in this, which is disappointing because power and torque are, outputs are middling at best. So it's rated at 9.7 liters per 100 kilometers on the combined cycle with this. A small SUV, that's not great.
What is a powertrain?
Yeah, good question. Yeah. So it's the naturally aspirated 2.4-litre four-cylinder petrol engine with 129 kilowatts of power and 229 newton metres of torque. That's mated to a 9-speed torque converter automatic. Now, this engine's been around for a few years. As Jack actually reported, they're phasing it out from the Cherokee. But it's fundamentally, it's not like it's completely underpowered. But there's certainly no surplus of power here.
It's just kind of adequate, more or less. Like it just kind of does the job. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, and what's frustrating is the chassis of the Compass is actually pretty like decent. Like it feels like if you just had a better, more powerful engine in there. And I know Jeep has got some, you know, sitting in its parts bin. There's a turbocharged 2-liter four cylinder that they offer in the Cherokee overseas. That and the Compass, that might kind of bring it alive.
That engine, by the way, I've driven that in a Wrangler. That is a cracker. That 2-liter turbo four is. I don't know why Jeep don't bring that to Australia, even in the Wrangler, because I drove that about 2,000 Ks a few years ago, and it was literally like quick out of the blocks. Like I couldn't believe how this thing was like virtually bordering on a hot hatch in a Wrangler. It was phenomenal, and I would have thought that'd be awesome for off-roading as well. So, yeah, why that engine hasn't made it here, it's a mystery. I'd love to find out.
And the unfortunate thing is they haven't engineered it for the Compass in any market. But what I'm kind of getting at here, though, is Jeep has to be able to justify why its Compass is so much more expensive than similarly specified rivals. And if it had a more powerful engine like that or something to really justify that extra expense, I'd be able to say, hey, look, everybody, put the Jeep Compass on your list. But it's just a little bit overpriced.
The only thing I would say is it potentially, is it, you know, with its off-road equipment that you just mentioned or the technology, is that more than you would get in a equivalent Kona or Seltos? Wow. In terms of, I don't know what, you know, comparing their all-wheel drive drivetrains to, is it apples with apples or is the Jeep more off-road capable?
I have something.
That's the only thing I could that would suggest that, and I don't know the answer to that without going into all the specs, you know, line by line.
Yeah, really, really trying to find a lifeline there for the Compass. I mean, I think the only way to tell would be to really test one of these back to back with, you know, an all drive Seltos. So that, sorry, what were you saying, Jack?
Yeah, I was just going to say exactly along the lines of the all wheel drive Seltos. I know that the Seltos all wheel drive has a dual clutch that really struggles off road, overheats and doesn't like it at all. So I'm guessing this Compass is already one up on that, even though it's not like a proper off-roader in any sense. It's kind of got the kit and it's kind of got the heritage behind it that you can maybe get to a campsite if you'd like or mild-ish off-roading, which you might not want to do in a Seltos.
I also wonder how many Compass buyers are actually trying to do that.
That's very true.
Think about the kind of average small crossover buyer, are they really looking for that level of capability? I mean, maybe in a Grand Cherokee they are. In a Wrangler, I hope they would be. Otherwise, why the hell would you buy it? But fundamentally, if there is a little bit of off-road ability more than other rivals in this class, I'm not sure if it's still worth the premium there. It's just disappointing because it has a really nice interior. This Compass wants for nothing in terms of features. Right. But what I found really interesting is when you actually look at what it's priced up against, not only is it thousands more than similarly specified rivals, but you're actually looking at not far off from Jeep's own Cherokee Limited, which has a V6 engine and more space for just a little bit more coin. And then if you're looking in like that kind of price point, you go up a little bit higher and you're looking at like base Audi Q3 and Volvo XC40 money. And the thing about those models is, yeah, sure, they might not have as much standard kit as this, you know, pretty much fully decked out Compass, but they're you know, they have more kind of brand cred and, you know, typically punchier, you know, more efficient engines. So it's just a little bit disappointing. I think Jeep really needs to just kind of reduce the prices here. And what I found really interesting is if you just look at Jeep sales figures, the small SUV segment is absolutely booming, right? Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's getting in there. It's where the sales are. But the Compass isn't Jeep's best-selling model, not by long stretch. The Grand Cherokee is, and then the Wrangler, and then there's a pretty fair drop down to the Compass. Mm. And if you look over at the Cherokee as well, which is just sitting there and could be sitting there for several years without getting any meaningful updates, you've got Jeep not targeting two of the biggest SUV segments in the market properly. So look, you know, Jeep, hey, if you're listening, slash the prices a little bit, and then I think there'll be a more favorable verdict there.
Yeah, I think Jeep has a strategy of pushing their products into a premium sphere. I think that's their strategy going forward. That's certainly the case, or going to be the case, with the Grand Cherokee L when it lands here. There, that's going to push into, you know, Audi Q7 and Volvo XC90, you know, with a brand new generation, new look. I expect it's going to have a lot of luxury, and I suspect they're trying to filter that push into the premium segment down for all their model lines. And whether it works or not is yet to be.
I'll say, though, about Grand Cherokee, if you look at where the current Grand Cherokee is, and I genuinely really like the Grand Cherokee, I think it's aged really well. I had a chance to drive one for a little bit the other year. the other day. But with the Grand Cherokee, when you look at what it's going up against, it has a very different kind of on-road feel to, you know, SUVs at its price point, like the Everest and things like that, whereas this Compass just kind of feels more like every other crossover in its segment. So it just doesn't feel as special. Maybe Jeep is relying on that kind of cachet filtering down to the Compass, but fundamentally this needs to have something more to it to really stand out in this segment, and it needs to have a slightly lower price. I will say one thing, though. If you haven't sat in a Jeep Compass since the first generation model, if you get in this, you will be absolutely gobsmacked. I don't like to do that whole kind of reductive, oh, this is so much better than the last one. Because, you know, whenever there's a new model comes out, a lot of people are very quick to say, oh, the old one was crap. But the first generation Compass was genuinely not good. And to its credit, even though that ad had a bit of a mixed reception, Jeep gave it a redesign. And it was, you know, pretty decent. And now they've given that a pretty substantial mid-cycle update. And the interior is absolutely banished of all of the horrible gremlins of the first generation interior, with one exception, and it is the indicator and the stalks on the steering column.
Yeah,
I've noticed it in the Wrangler as well. They are the cheapest. It is like raw spaghetti. They are the cheapest, flimsiest things. And I swear the rest of the interior is genuinely nice.
Would that be handmade spaghetti, Will?
You're more Italian than me. But I think Jeep just has a big bin full of these stalks that they must have bought back in the old, you know, Daimler Chrysler Dodge Caliber days. And they're trying to use them up. Look, Stellantis, just, you need to burn that parts bin and you need to get new stalks.
I'm sure they've heard that one then.
Yes.
Will, you have given it a 7.6 Car Expert rating. The review is live now. Thank you very much, William Stopford.
Thanks, guys.
Hello, Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy Turner. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for joining us. Now, let's talk Mitsubishi, because it seems Mitsubishi Australia has a problem, as you've written, and that's Australians don't know what plug-in hybrids are. So before we do get into this story, we probably should say what a FEV is, or a plug-in hybrid is.
Yeah, so it's the kind of middle ground between a Toyota-style normal hybrid, where a very small battery and motor assists a petrol engine, and then a proper Tesla-style electric car. So the theory is that you get sort of 50 Ks or maybe more like 40 Ks of daily electric driving, and then after that, a little petrol engine generator kicks in as backup to kind of remove the fear of range anxiety. So they're really popular in Europe. Mitsubishi's been selling them in Australia for about 7 years now. It was the first mainstream brand to really launch the tech, and it's sold just under 4,000 in that time, but it's had some quotes during the week, and based on some market research, it said it just hasn't really been able to get any cut through, and customers just don't really associate the technology with the brand Mitsubishi, which I got to say kind of surprised me.
Why do you think they've only sold about 4,000? There's not enough education out there for people to understand? Like, why is this happening?
Yeah, well, I mean, as recently as 2 years ago, this survey found that 75% of people that they interviewed considered themselves to have little to no familiarity with what a plug-in hybrid is and what it does. And the finding was that people are really well versed on Toyota hybrids. They totally get that tech. And electric cars, what's the mystery? They're really easy to work out. But this middle ground where there's the interplay between, you know, different propulsion systems, and it's all very contingent on the behaviors and how you use it, is quite complex, and it just hasn't really got the cut through. And then you add in the fact that there's definitely a price premium as well. And they probably don't have the mighty Toyota marketing budget to spend, which doesn't help either. And you add all those things up, and they just haven't really cut through. And then I suppose that the other part of the picture is across Europe in particular, there are subsidies and tax incentives and CO2 caps that encourage the take up of these vehicles more than we do in Australia. So you add that into the list, and I guess it's no big surprise that the humble plug-in hasn't really made much of a dent in Australia yet.
What other makes produce FEVs, and do you know if they're also struggling with the awareness around the technology?
Yeah, certainly in Australia, it's definitely getting a lot more common now. So the majority of brands around the world make a lot of plug-in hybrids, and quite a few of them are in Australia. So Mercedes-Benz is quite big in this space. It's got lots. Ford is about to launch the Escape plug-in hybrid in the same sort of segment as the Mitsubishi. Peugeot's got some. I think Volkswagen just confirmed a Touareg version with plug-in hybrid. So it sort of spans across the market, certainly getting a lot more common. But I guess what was interesting about this was that because Mitsubishi, in my mind, is so synonymous with that technology, and it was the first brand to really push that technology in Australia, that if it's struggling to get any cut through in recognition, then it stands to reason that everybody is. So even though we're seeing more and more of these cars arriving, will they actually make an impact, and do people understand how the technology works? And I guess more fundamentally, which we'll touch on in my review later, does this technology actually make sense in Australia in a broader sense as well?
So does Mitsubishi have an answer to this, to their problem, I should say?
Well, a lot of advertising and marketing and, you know, building that brand seems to be part of it. They've changed the naming structure, so they don't use the term PHEV or FEV anymore. They call it a plug-in hybrid EV, which sort of spells out what it is. And I guess a lot of it's just going to be around just talking about it, making a lot of noise about it. Having two products is going to help a lot. So this new Eclipse Cross plug-in hybrid EV, to use their terminology, will join a new generation Outlander version that arrives early next year. So that will help as well. And just continuing to push it. And I guess, you know, getting ambassadors, getting people behind the wheel. And I guess hopefully the goal eventually for the brand is to make it as synonymous with Mitsubishi as hybrid is with Toyota.
Okay, so as you just said before, while we have you, I think it should be timely to review the Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross FEV, or plug-in hybrid EV. Now, for anyone who isn't familiar with this model, what is it and where does it sit within the Mitsubishi range?
Yeah, so the Mitsubishi Eclipse is a badge that some car fans will know from a coupe that was sold in America in the 90s. Crawf, I'm thinking you probably are pretty familiar with the Mitsubishi Eclipse coupe.
Yeah, I am.
So the Eclipse Cross is not quite that. It's a bit different. Sort of size-wise, it's recently had an update to give it a bit more differentiation. So it's bigger than an ASX, it's smaller than an Outlander, which is about to grow as it enters a new generation form. In terms of price and size, it's a bit more edgy in design than the ASX. And this one is, yeah, it's obviously the plug-in hybrid version. It uses the exact same drivetrain as the outgoing Outlander plug-in hybrid, so nothing too surprising under the skin. And in terms of pricing, it kicks off at $49,990 on the road, so $50,000. They've got under that psychological barrier for the drive-away price for the sort of fleet-focused base ES. And then it's a few grand more into the mid-spec Aspire that I drove this week, and then a few grand more again into the top-of-the-range one with the double sunroof and leather and all the good stuff. So 50 to 60 grand, which is a premium of about $13,000 over the equivalent all-wheel drive petrol Eclipse Cross. So there is not an exact science as to how much all this tech costs, but it's about $13,000 when you strip away all of the other variables, which to me is a little bit high.
What are the real benefits of – this is a double-barrel question. The real benefits of going FEV for a start, particularly with this vehicle, and do you see the benefit of paying the extra dollars and quite a few extra dollars, I might add, for the fuel economy?
Yeah, so I don't think you can make an economic argument for a FEV in the same way as you can for a Toyota hybrid. You can quite easily quantify with a Camry hybrid. It's $2,500 more than a non-hybrid, but my fuel consumption will be 50% lower. So I can work out on the back of an envelope at what point it will become more cost effective to buy. Plug-in hybrid, that $13,000 price differential, you're never ever going to recoup on petrol alone. The fuel economy is so contingent on charging. So the way a plug-in works, for those who aren't quite across it, is the first 40 or 50 Ks is pure EV. And then when that battery is depleted, it uses the petrol engine as a generator to drive the wheels. So if you're doing long trips, the economy kind of becomes like a hybrid car, but a little bit heavier because of all the batteries it's sort of carrying. So you're never going to make the money back, but there are a lot of upsides to it in terms of the way it drives. It's got a lot of really interesting features that make it unique compared to the other Eclipse Crosses. So if you think about it in those terms, it sort of does make a bit more sense.
I just wanted to know where would it suit best? I think I already know the answer of where this plug-in hybrid EV would suit best, but I keep on just thinking of the people. Like, I think of my parents in particular, who live out in the country, and if they're maybe driving 30 Ks into town, 30 Ks out of town, if they want to get a little bit frugal and environmentally friendly, would this be something that you'd recommend for them, or would you steer them away from it?
Yeah, look, so I look at this in through the same sort of framework as of having family sort of far away as well. A cheap EV is not really going to suit somebody in the country. And this has that great benefit of daily errands as a pure EV to do your bit for the environment, and you don't have to worry about conking out on long trips. So yes. But then I guess a part of me also thinks, well, maybe you're better off saving 13 grand, buying the petrol one and buying a really awesome home solar array with the money, and maybe you're doing more for the environment then. But I don't know. That's sort of – this is where it becomes a little bit, when you try to actually make a cost argument for this, it makes less sense. But then again – some of the cool things about the Eclipse Cross plug-in hybrid, for instance, it's a two-motor all-wheel drive system. So rather than a mechanical all-wheel drive system, you've got an electric motor on each axle. And so when you're doing soft roading or when you need more traction, you cannot possibly match the instantaneous response of motors on the axle. So it's got a really, really cool all-wheel drive system. It's faster and more punchy, smoother at low speeds because it runs like a regular sort of inline hybrid when the battery is depleted. So it's always a more pleasant experience than the non-plug-in hybrid one as well. So again, I think the technology is, it's going to look good to people on paper when they sort of think, right, I could kind of tweak my lifestyle to suit the vehicle, but it's not a vehicle that's just going to lend itself to every way of life. And I kind of worry if, initially it might work for you, but maybe in the fullness of time it won't.
Is it quicker 0 to 100 because of that electric start off the?
Oh, it's no rocket ship. I did a 9.5 second 0 to 100 sort of time. So half of the course for a small family SUV like this. It's very smooth. It drives like a regular hybrid when you really floor it because the petrol engine's helping, but it's still electric off the mark. But it's no rocket ship, no.
Okay. It just sounds like a more, like you said, it's a more interesting car to drive than your average car. Look, I was quite impressed with the standard Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross that we had at the Experience Center, which was a top spec with leather and all that. And I was quite impressed with the size and the space packaging of it. It's got a lot of rear leg room, decent boot space, and quite a modern bit of kit, to be honest, for the non-hybrid at least was priced quite well, I thought, for the amount of kit that it had.
Fundamentally, what makes the regular hybrid work better for most people is the regular hybrid doesn't require any change in behavior whatsoever. You just get in it, stick fuel in it and drive, and you know that the magic of that electric system is helping out. It's being charged up internally through brake regen. You never have to plug it in. Plug-in hybrids, if you plug it in every night and you're diligent with that and you know, you're making sure that you're keeping it charged as often as you can, it can save you a ton of money, but it requires you to change the way that you interact with your car. But not only that, you've also got to, as you say, Croft, service the petrol engine and fuel the petrol engine as well. So it is a slightly more challenging car to live with that may suit some people's lifestyles, but it certainly is a reason, I think, why the technology doesn't cut through, especially given the price premium that it still commands. If it can come down closer to a normal hybrid in premium, maybe, but as it stands, it's a little bit pricey, I think.
Fair enough.
Did you agree with Croft's comments about the practicality and space in it?
Yeah, look, I actually quite like the way it looks. I think it's pretty funky. The interior, the infotainment system works just fine. It's only got phone mirroring, no sat nav until you're in the top one. It's not the most exciting interior in the world. And I mean, the rear windows, it's got that kind of sporty kinked window line. So the visibility out isn't amazing. It's not quite as airy as the Outlander. But yeah, it's a nice size and it looks all right and it's pretty well packaged. So it's just a daily car. It does the job pretty well.
Yeah. Have you given it a car expert rating yet, Marco?
Yes, I have. I gave it a 7.7. And I guess, you know, I admire the car. I admire its technology. I really think Mitsubishi probably does this system better than most. But I do also think it's a car that's very contingent on a certain lifestyle. So you just really need to do your homework and make sure it works for you, I think, is the important advice with this car.
Marco, what's its direct competitor?
The MGHS plug-in and the Kia Niro plug-in are the only two like sort of minded plug-in hybrids around that same $50,000 mark. There's also a Mini Countryman plug-in hybrid and a Volvo XC40 plug-in hybrid that are about 20 grand more. So, you know, it's sort of, in terms of price, it does line up relatively well against its competitors. You can also get a Toyota RAV4 normal hybrid for 50 grand in top spec guys. And that vehicle on long trips will probably be just as efficient. It just doesn't have the party trick of, you know, 40 Ks of EV range like the Mitsubishi does. So there's definitely other cars to look at, you know, if you're interested in kicking the tires.
The thing is, I suppose if I think Mandy only drives 20 or less Ks to and from work, do you, Mandy? Or
10 K each way.
So you could effectively get away with ever putting fuel in that car.
Absolutely.
Effectively, and if you needed to go on a long trip to Lawn or some nice place out of Melbourne, you could actually you do that because you've got the extra engine. So I suppose in that sense, they do make practical sense at the moment where we don't have a lot of battery electric vehicles out there, certainly not affordable, you know.
Yeah, and this is the thing. We could argue it all day. It suits, you know, I wish we had a pint and we were in a pub rather than doing this in a Zoom with four different disparate different screens. But, yeah, look, for every case where it works, there's a case where it doesn't. But for some people, it will definitely work. And, you know, I really do commend Mitsubishi for launching this car and offering this technology.
Yeah.
As I said, just do your homework and make sure it's, you know, make sure you're the sort of person that lends yourself to this kind of car.
Mm. All right, we might leave it there. Thank you very much for your time, Mike Costello.
Oh, good, guys.
That's an end for this week's podcast. Croft, what are you looking at your computer?
I'm literally gobsmacked, Mandy. I'm just reading on our site. Michelin prepares for airless tire launch for 2024.
How is that possible?
Oh, these are I've actually seen versions of this in like science fiction about 5 years ago, and this is the end of flat tires, guys. like they're the weirdest looking tires. They are so strange, and it's a partnership between Michelin and General Motors, this particular version. They've been tested on all electric Chevy Bolt and the Mini Cooper SE in Germany. They're puncture-proof. They don't need air in order to be inflated.
How does it work then?
Jack, do you know?
Yeah, I do know. I wrote this story. It's been in the works for a long time, roughly like 10 years. So it's not something that's come around relatively quickly. They look freaking cool. And so the way that it works is on the tread looks the same. It's all kind of the same tread, but the difference is when you look on the side, it just looks bizarre because there's no sidewall and there's all these like little, they call them spokes. And so they're rubber filament, and there's also fiberglass in there that kind of helps it create the shape. So it's gonna be, as Croft said, without like airless. So, and it's not gonna be able to like have the same kind of punctures that we have in our current pneumatic tires. So with it, they're targeting fleets, first of all, and then they're also going to OEMs, the Michelin and GMR. And then last of all, as Croft said, they're targeting third world countries or other countries that are prone to punctures. So it's pretty cool to see. I know that this is going to be launched in 2024, but there's already a tire like it on the market. It's already there. So the particular tire that we're talking about right now is called the Uptus. I can't quite remember what it stands for. I was literally looking at it today, but that's what it stands for. But there's another type of tire that Michelin already manufactures, and it's for like light vehicle, like ATVs, ride on mowers and things like that. And they can buy, consumers can already buy that in North America. So the technology is already there.
I'm not seeing this going to be relevant for sports cars, and because it seems to give too much,
or even like there's too much.
There's too much flex in the sidewall.
It does look like a flat tire. I'm not going to lie.
It 100% does, but I get why you've one of the things you've written, Jack, and I have heard about this before, is there are 200 million tires scrapped each year worldwide. Yep. 200 million.
Wow.
Now, where does that rubber go? And look, there are various companies that make roads out of rubber. That's certainly being talked about now. But you can't just put these into landfill because we'll run out of space. So I guess this is going to make a tire last a lot longer than a standard tire, and you'll probably be able to get retreads rather than having to buy new tires, which seems to make sense.
Yeah, it definitely gives them the flexibility to kind of have, like, I remember watching a video and saying them saying that you can get like a summer tire and then get like a winter tire, just like normal tires. It's going to really, pardon the pun, they're going to be reinventing the wheel physically. So it's going to be really interesting to see where this technology leads to. This
amazing.
Because it's there. It's already there. Right.
That's amazing.
Really,
yeah.
Really exciting times. All right, guys, we should wrap up this baby. Tony Crawford and Jack Quick, thank you so much.
Mandy, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me again, Mandy. I really appreciate it. Thank you.